Your old or broken phone can let you down when you need it most.
Perfect.
But at Verizon, trade in any old phone from our top brands and get the most for it. Up to $2,000 in value for an amazing new iPhone 16 Pro with Apple Intelligence and a new line on my plan. And iPad and Apple Watch Series 10. That's like a 3-for-1. And you can get it on any plan. At Verizon, trade in your old phone for a brand new iPhone 16 Pro, iPad, and Apple Watch. The other guys won't give you that. Visit Verizon.com today. Additional terms apply. Service plan required for Apple Watch and iPad. Up to $2,000 value based on iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch.
Taxes was feeling so stuck. Sitting in traffic, squeezing into a parking spot, all to squeeze in getting tax help during your lunch break. Now Taxes is a TurboTax expert who does your taxes for you, while you go about your day getting real-time notifications about their progress and the most money back guaranteed. Now this is Taxes, Intuit TurboTax. Get an expert now on TurboTax.com. Only available with TurboTax Live Full Service, real-time updates only in iOS mobile apps. See guarantee details at TurboTax.com/guarantees.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Welcome back to One Heat Minute Productions. I'm your host, Blake Howard. This is a very special interview. Special because it's close to my heart. Special because it's an Aussie film. Special because it's a filmmaker who I have the utmost respect for and an actor who I have longed to speak to for his entire career. So this is a real bucket listy kind of affair. This, as you would have seen, hopefully on your podcast feed of choice, is an interview about the upcoming film Spit, which is the long overdue, 22 years in fact, sequel to the Australian caper classic Gettin' Square. And today, I have a real treat for you. Got a great little interview with the star of Spit and Gettin' Square, David Wenham. Yes, relentless scene stealer, as I call him in the beginning of interview, in a non-pejorative way, and the great filmmaker behind one of the greatest Australian films I think I've ever seen, Burning Man and The Railway Man. It's Jonathan Teplitsky, who also directed the original Gettin' Square. I chatted to both of these gents in their sort of preliminary release of Spit and talked to them about the film coming back together, the comedy, the character enduring, and of course, because of the origins of One Heat Minute Productions, I got a special public enemy story from David Wenham about working with Michael Mann and Johnny Depp. Can't wait for you to hear it. Desperate for you to check out the movie. Gettin' Square is a stone cold classic, and Spit is the kind of T2 train spotting to Gettin' Square's train spotting. Hits you really hard, lingers with you long. Really enjoyable film. Great to see with a crowd. Hope you see it. Here's a trailer. And then we get to the interview with Jonathan and David.
International fugitive. Money launderer. Criminal mastermind. John Francis Spiteri.
Who?
Lock him up.
This is Australia. It's still a free country, isn't it?
Why are you in this place?
Oh, mate, there's just a tragic case of mistaken identity. Partners?
This is your driver's license.
No, that's not me. He's got squinty eyes. I don't have squinty eyes.
You're under arrest, John.
Why are you in jail?
I'm going to get out of here. When I do, I'm going to look after you and the little one.
John Francis Spiteri has been located alive.
Disaster.
Johnny Spit.
John Spiteri opens his mouth. You and I are fucked.
Fucked.
Fuck!
Fuck.
Ari Sani. Reasonable doubt at a reasonable price.
Bail refused.
Bail refused.
Bail refused. We want to know where the money got to and we want names.
I've got a little kid to look out for.
You saved this little boy.
I'm his uncle.
You had red hair like me.
Yeah, biscuit they used to call me. Yeah, like ginger nut, because I had ginger nuts.
Johnny Spit ain't gonna grass you up, is he? Johnny was a clock, he wouldn't even tell the time.
You
always been running.
I'm not going to run no more.
Hey!
You are, in fact, John Francis Battiri, are you not?
Excuse me, Your Honor. I'm currently suffering from a very bad case of amnesthesia.
David, Jonathan, so great to see you both. Congratulations on this.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you a quick question and take you back 22 years because, David, you are a relentless scene stealer in movies in the best possible way. And I just want to know,
so
because
it's not pejorative, okay?
Not pejorative. It's like the biggest compliment I can give is because wherever you're in a movie, it's like I'm going to be staring at you. So I wanted to know, Jonathan, when you were making Getting Square, at what point did you kind of go, oh, this, it's actually this guy's movie. Like, it's actually Spitt's movie in a weird way.
Yeah, look, you know, I right from the word go, I'd just done a film, David and I had just done a film together.
You did, yeah.
And I really, really wanted him to play Spittieri. And one of the things, you know, David loves to play characters that are a million miles away from who he really is.
Yes.
And I always just, I love that sort of... that sort of dynamic in a way. And I just knew that he would do something amazing. And so we always looked at Getting Square as an ensemble piece. Yeah. And it was very much about the relationships and what have you. And then, you know, as soon as I remember on the read through, you know, and Tim Spaller was still with jet lag, he'd just arrived from the UK. And we were literally like 10 minutes into the read through and he just turned to me and just went like that. Gave me a big thumbs up because David had just done his first scene. And he knew he was going to be in something where, because Tim is, you know, the archetypal character actor, and he knew that he was in an ensemble with other great characters. And I think that was the kind of first indication that we were really going to go somewhere, you know, surprising, but also really, you know, really kind of fantastic. So, you know, I would never sort of clarify it as one character's film or the other. You know, it's very much about the relationships and how they work off each other. But, you know, Spittieri took on this sort of, beyond our wildest dreams and also beyond anything we'd really thought of, just took on a character that sort of got into people's consciousness. And David, I'm sure, will you know, articulate it better than me, but it's about a character that is very... on the surface, he seems very, you know, he has a lot of faults. He has, you know, he's a junkie. He's this, that, and the other. This isn't Getting Square. But he has a great unjudgmental quality that is very powerful, I think. And I think people really identify with that.
Yeah. Well, right from the get-go, Sam Worthington's character's like, my first night in the joint, who put his hand on my shoulder?
Yeah, exactly.
Johnny Spitt. Yeah. And then that sort of sets it up. Mm. But did you find that when you were looking at Johnny Spitt, David, were you like, oh, this is a guy I can just have a ball with? Like, I imagine we're looking back on it now, but do you remember anything about that preliminary reading of going, oh, I'm going to just have a field day with this guy?
I knew from the first time that I read the script, Chris Nye's script, I thought, yeah, this is something pretty special because Chris is a criminal lawyer. He'd seen characters like Spittieri in The Dock. One particular guy that he remembers seeing, whereby he was watching him and didn't know if he was the dumbest person in The Dock or the smartest person he'd ever seen on The Dock. And that was his kernel of the idea for the creation of Spittieri. For me, I have spent most of my life, the majority of my life, living down from King's Cross,
yeah,
in and around there. I've seen characters like Johnny Spittieri my whole life.
Yeah.
I've been an ambassador for Wayside for quite some time. I've seen there many, many characters like Johnny Spittieri. So as soon as I read that script the first time, I thought, oh my God, Chris has nailed not only the language of this character, but rhythmically it was just, I knew exactly how that character spoke. I knew how he moved. I knew how he thought. It was like, it was a gift. It was manna from heaven for me.
That's unreal.
I mean, reading the script for the first time, it was an incredible laugh out loud experience. And you don't come across that often. But also, as David says, there was a, like almost a Damien Runyon type of rhythm to the whole script. Mm. And because it described, you know, very, very economically the way that Spittieri walked or the sound of the thongs or just little nuanced bits, you sort of just got this sort of sense of momentum, the sense of a character walking through life in his own sort of world. And that was really appealing. I remember that very clearly.
It was a highlight for me seeing the new film. You talked about the dock scene and I feel like you had a field day And I wish I'd seen it with a bigger audience, because I was probably laughing the other people I saw the film with to pieces. Just watching you guys get Johnny Spit back in the courtroom again and having an absolute field day. So was that your goal, to sort of try and top or match the quality of those like iconic scenes? Because I feel like those scenes are just, they're made to be clipped up and just laughed at consistently, just as a piece of comedy in a movie.
Yeah, I mean, we always wanted the challenge of going back to the courtroom,
yes. You
know, because of the iconic status of the first one. But you know, that in itself is a real challenge as well. But you know, quite early on, David suggested this idea about, you know, to do with age, to do with aging, and using the glasses as a thing. And so that's where that sort of started to sort of take hold. And once we'd hit upon something that we thought Spiteri could spin out long enough, then it really sort of came to life. Yeah.
Great.
What was interesting about that is, not only are there, you know, key cast members who have returned, it's pretty much all heads of department are pretty much the same. Gary Phillips, who shot the film, Nick McCallum, who designed the film, Jonathan directed and whatever. And I can remember when we walked back into that courtroom after having not been there for 23 years, and literally there was a silence among us when we just moved in and we took in the space. And it was the most peculiar thing, because it felt as though time had just condensed. And it felt like it was only last week that we were actually doing something similar. It was quite freaky, actually.
Yeah, it was an amazing sense of deja vu.
Yeah,
it really
I was
going
to say, all those people were just all looking around, a little bit older, like,
because you know, you walk
22 years gone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you also walk into locations like that, because the first thought in your mind is, how am I going to do the scene in here? And in a sense, we'd done it, because there's no other camera angles that we could have used, you know. Yeah. And so it was returning to something that we'd done, but also trying to make it of its own and an advancement or whatever you want to call it. But in a sense, not just repeating ourselves.
Mm. So you guys back working together, I was watching Getting Square, refamiliarizing myself, which it's sort of been criminally underseen. I think the live streaming services is that everything is available in hand and it's not. It's an old DVD for the longest time until very recently, which is super frustrating, but it's great that it's out now. But going back to it, I was just so shocked at, like, there was something about a kind of the Gold Coast sleaze at the time. And the gloss that I see in Spit is so reflective of now. So was that a fun dichotomy of, like, the Gold Coast kind of like growing? Because it feels like the Gold Coast always gets a facelift every 10 years, and you guys go back now, and it's like,
well, you know,
everyone's slicker. Everything's slicker about it.
I mean, a lot of where we shot Getting Square was in Southport, and the same with this film, but it was always a great challenge this time around, because so much of those great little alleyways, those great little iconic sleazy sort of back streets have gone and replaced by high rise. I mean, there's so many more high rise now.
Yeah.
But I couldn't believe it I've recce'd the Gold Coast, you know, all over the place for not just these jobs, but other ones.
Yeah.
And then when we discovered that squash court
and
that apartment block, I must have driven it past it 50 times and never seen it.
Yes.
And so there's still these little pockets which allowed us to kind of revisit the sort of the underbelly, if you like, of the Gold Coast. But it's always a challenge as well, because at street level, there's a lot of street furniture that is very, very, you know, modern and contemporary and not, you know, not always the most aesthetic.
Yes.
Which is one of the reasons when we did Getting Square, we had quite a low camera angle often.
Yes.
So that you take in these big sort of panoramic shots with the, and everything, because it goes up, you want to be able to see it, these big blue skies and all that. But it's also, they're both the films that are about little characters in large environments, often swamped by their environments. And so it sort of suited the sort of aesthetic that we were going for.
I love the whole theme of the first one. Feels like really, even if it's like subtext, it's like putting a scrutiny on like what Australia is. It's like a bunch of people trying to do the best with what they can. Some of them have made mistakes and they're just trying to get by.
Yeah.
And in this movie, it's like, it's even more apparent. It's like there's all these sort of shades of people messing around and corruption. And it's just people wanting to come back and just claw to get home.
Yeah,
and it felt in a weird way like Getting Square made me howl and laugh and revisit many times, but it's a bit kind of hung around. And I want to give that compliment is like because the themes of the movie, it's so like right on Front Street. It's Johnny wanting to come home, but then it just stuck with me, like how desperate you are just to just for that little tiny piece of home. It's not about this huge aspiration.
No, not
like Timothy Spall's character, huge buildings, huge aspirations. It's like, I just want my little slice of home. I just want my family. I just want to be back home. And it was like, escape was the theme of the first one. And it's like now everyone rushing to get back. So tackling some more like serious themes in this one, was that naturally sort of what you guys had and Chris had kind of grown into over the last like 22 years? Like, is that, did that feel like it would be inauthentic if you didn't tackle that sort of like what Australia is?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a really good observation, but I also think, you know, we've all grown older and our interest, we didn't want to do the same thing. We didn't want to make Getting Square 2. And so we wanted to, and we wanted, this is a more of a character piece, whereas Getting Square is sort of more of a caper.
Yes.
And we wanted to explore Spiteri, not just the comedic character, but also, you know, a deeper emotional life that he would have had. And so, you know, and the thing about it was they all served the comedy.
Yes.
And it you know, the emotion, the drama and what have you, and some of these hurdles that he goes through just only add to the comedic nature of the film, I think. And it just gives Spiteri a more deeper, rounded character that is an advancement in many ways on what the first film was trying to do.
I love your description of belonging.
Yes.
Because for us as well, it's about, you know, finding a home and also new beginnings.
Yes.
And if you asked us exactly what we think the film's about, I think both of us would say it's about what it is to be Australian, but more importantly, it's about mateship.
Yes.
And we discover that Spiteri, for all his flaws and faults and idiosyncrasies and strange characteristics, he's a good man who is unjudgmental, irrespective of what you look like, your religion, your pay packet, your profession. He's going to treat you exactly the same.
Yeah.
And at the end of the film, yeah, people come out, I think, really feeling quite buoyant and feeling as though, yeah, I wouldn't mind being Johnny Spiteri's mate.
That's his best. It's his best quality. And even in the caper structure of Getting Square, it's like, the whole thing, you're like, oh, please, Johnny, you know, no matter how many times you watch it, you're like, please, Johnny, don't do this, don't mess this up. But he's right along for the caper. That's the fun, like, twist of the first. So you get that, you're like, oh, God, he's good. And then, you know, the film ends with Getting Square and we see him disappear and we see him return in this. So I really found that special.
Well, I'm really glad you did, because that was certainly an important ingredient for us while we were making it, and it just felt like it was an advancement. You know, it was taking the new film to another place.
Yeah, a kind of more touching space than you expect with Johnny Spit.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like you're just kind of, you know what you're going to get. He does what he says on the tin, but I think that you guys got to surprise. I wanted to talk about a couple other things, so I've got you guys here, David. I think you belong part of. If Johnny Spit is one of your most popular characters that was unexpected out of Getting Square, you're also part of what I think is the best functioning fandom in the world, which is Lord of the Rings. And I see your face in memes all day on Instagram and on film Twitter. But
yeah,
just Faramir, like, do you must get such an outpouring of love? Is it weird to be like, we do encounter people who know you as certain things, like for us Aussies who, like, this is a really dear movie to us for a certain generation. But then there's, like, at the same time you made Lord of the Rings, these things are hanging around in such a really special way. How does that make you feel?
Oh, look, both of them were sort of gifts to be involved in, really, and I feel privileged to have been involved in both worlds. Oh, yeah, Lord of the Rings is, obviously, that's, you know, it's a classic that I feel completely privileged to be involved in, and it's an evergreen, that one. What's fascinating is to see different generations discovering not only the books but the movies as well, and really just sort of grabbing hold of them and loving them. But equally, this character, as you say, he was a support character in a film from 22 years ago. But he probably is the character, in this country at least, that I get asked about more than anything else, even more than Faramir or 300 or whatever. This character, for whatever reason, which is sort of fascinating in a way.
I said your line, 500,000. There you go. Who's got my bus fare?
Exactly.
Who's got my bus fare?
It's like, amazing. I had a guy only just before Christmas. I was at a gallery in Brisbane, and after I'd been to the gallery, I was just walking back to find where I'd parked a car, and I heard this guy yelling at me, and I turned around, and it was a public bus that had pulled up next to me. The bus driver, there were passengers on it, the bus driver opened up the door of the bus and yelled out to me, "Well, I hope you got your bus money, because I'm not going to let you on the bus." It's like, I honestly couldn't believe it. I thought, this is crazy. It's like 22 years ago after that film, and people are still sort of, you know, have it at their fingertips ready to deliver.
It's great. It's good to hear. There's a small Public Enemies Michael Mann head fandom that I'm a part of that would be up there asking you. We'll be asking you about that as opposed to Johnny Spear.
Oh,
I think we're not as normal as everyone else. So no, that's
just different.
It's just different. Yeah. Just different. I'm interested because something I love about Getting Square is just it's so tactile. They're just the look and the feel of the film. You come back, you guys are both super experienced across multi mediums now. Does it give you any additional freedoms now, thinking about the aesthetic and filming like in digital and those sorts of things that are now prevalent? Does it give you more freedom, like to be more dynamic now, do you think? Or is there sort of stylistic things that you have to sort of reorchestrate if you're trying to get it to feel the same? Because when I was looking at them, I watched them probably a week or so apart, Spit and then Getting Square again. And I was like, I was trying to match it, but I needed a second watch. But I was like, I was trying to go, okay, but how much of that feels like at the courtroom, obviously. But was there something specific, Jonathan, for you that you're like, I want it to look and feel as much as possible like Getting Square? Or was there a whole new set of tools you're using?
Look, you know, I think the process has always been the process. Yeah. You know, whether you're putting the film in the camera and running, you know, running it like that or doing digital or whatever, you know, it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, you know, grading the film was, you know, it's probably more complicated now. It used to be really simple. And that's how, I mean, we shot all of Getting Square on film.
Yeah.
And really, you know, I don't really even think about that much. It's more about the dynamic of what we're trying to do, what story we're telling, the characters, some of the things we've already talked about, you know, the different elements within how that's going to work. You know, I have a very good shorthand with the DOP. I work with a lot, Gary Phillips, who shot both films, and we had an idea about the Gold Coast that we sort of took from Getting Square, but we also wanted to, you know, elaborate on. And one of the things I learned from Getting Square was not to overcomplicate not the shots, particularly in supposedly comedic scenes, because just to give it the space for the comedy to sort of feel as if it was organically being discovered in front of us.
Yeah.
You know, at times on Getting Square, I felt I probably had too much of a moving camera or did something like that. That in the edit we simplified, and so this time around we were much more just aware of the power of the simplicity of it.
Still, let you guys play.
Yeah.
You guys are obviously back together, but so much of the cast is back together. Mm. How fun was it to be with those folks, like getting everyone in from, you know, Gary Sweet? I mean, I could just go and rattle all the names, but how fun was it getting that band back together together?
And you know, it's also a lot of the crew.
The crew
the same. But on both counts, it was great, you know, and everyone was just had an excitement. Everyone's invested in Getting Square. It's a very special film for everyone who worked on it. So to sort of revisit that character and revisit some of the places was, you know, was fantastic.
David, we sort of started talking about this right at the top, which is that I'm a huge fan of Michael Mann, so it'd be really weird for me sitting in front of you not to talk a little bit about, like, Public Enemies and think it's casting your mind back. Could you share anything? Because I haven't ever had a chance to talk to you before, so I'm like, can you share anything about working with Mann and that film particularly? Because that's another one. He's always getting reappraised as a filmmaker, always getting re-looked at.
Yeah, he's a pretty extraordinary filmmaker. I was a very big fan, and specifically of Heat, so... Yeah, when I had the opportunity, it was great to drill him and get into dialogue about that particular film with him. All I can say is I remember I was asked to fly to Chicago to meet Michael on this film, and I had to go immediately, Michael said. So I was like, okay. So I flew from Sydney to Los Angeles and then to Chicago. And it was like 40 degrees in Sydney when I left. And when I landed in Chicago, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and it was like, I think it was minus 26 degrees with snow everywhere. 2 o'clock in the morning. The guy who picked me up, like Michael's assistant, whatever, he said, oh, look, you know you were supposed to meet Michael tomorrow morning, but he's at the studio now and he wants you to go straight to the studio. And it's like, are you for real? And he said, yes. Driving through Chicago, I'm completely like, I have no idea where I am. I go into the studio. He is the only person in there. And at that stage, it was probably about 3 a.m. And he had all the boards up on the room, whatever. And then he just literally, it was as though we were old friends and, you know, we had a great history and whatever. He walked over and was talking about, you know, all the little bits of costuming and whatever. He said, oh, come in here. Sat down, he gave me a book. And then he said, so would you like to do it? And it's like, what? I said, yeah, I'd love to. He said, okay, well, look, you have to be back here in, I think it was 3 days' time, because I'm having a dinner with Johnny Depp and I want the Hulk. And it was like, so I had to literally fly back to Sydney, pack my life up for whatever, because I was going to be in Chicago for 6 months, and I had to be back in Chicago in 3 days for this dinner with Johnny Depp. And Johnny turned up 5 weeks later.
I'm sorry, that's just such
I do. I do love Johnny. I do. I'd have a genuine love and affection for him.
That's the most Michael Mann, one of the most Michael Mann stories we've ever heard. That's fantastic.
Mm.
Fantastic, yeah. Tom Sizemore has a similar story on Heat, that he flew from Christmas dinner, called him at Christmas dinner, so I need you right now to come. So when you told me that story, I was like, oh my God, that's just...
Well, if Michael does that, well, you jump, you do it. Mm. Fair enough.
I guess lastly, as we're wrapping up, I just want to say like a huge congratulations on the film, and I just want to ask, like, do you guys have in your mind now, like, once you've done this, do you feel like a closure? Because you said you've been working for 10 years to get this back up. What was
we weren't ready to do it 10 years ago. To be fair, exactly. We were working on the film, and then it wasn't as though we were ready to go 10 years ago.
Things ebb and flow. You guys have an idea that it's going to pick up, and obviously you guys have got different.
Takes a while to get the script right.
You got to get it right. Yeah. What was it like when it was completed? Like, what was that feeling like of, like, this is now done, this huge chapter? Like, how does it feel?
It's happening right now. The fact is, Jonathan said when we screened it for the first time on the Gold Coast just over a week ago, it's like, now it's time to hand it over to the audience.
Yes.
And it is. It's their film now. We've done what we can. It's theirs. They can take ownership of the film. It is theirs.
Yeah, and look, that was very much, that's what we set out to do, is to make a film to bring this character back, give the audience something surprising, funny, all those sort of things, but then to hand it over to them, because they've repaid us in spades for Getting Square, and, you know, we wanted to, you know, do something that, you know, recreates that experience and, you know, give people that collective enjoyment and experience of sitting in a cinema and laughing together.
Love it. Thank you so much, guys.
Pleasure. Thanks, Blake. Cheers.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.